Bob Scully's World Show is brought to you by Walter Surface Technologies. Only the best. And by Clocks Technologies. Lighting the way to a brighter future.
Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of the World Show, the Free Markets series. Every country in the world is in favor of democracy until the time comes to practice it. And every government in the world is in favor of free trade until it comes time to practice it. There are many mysteries and paradoxes surrounding the whole notion of trade, and we wanted to clear a few of them up. So we went straight to the source, one of the world's greatest specialists on trade, Daniel Ikenson of the Cato Institute. Here he is. Daniel Ikenson, in what you describe as the love-hate relationship of America with trade, you've got this great metaphor where you compare the whole thing to the sports world, the wonderful world of sports, and it really works. So I'm going to quote you back what you wrote so that people get the point, and then we'll talk about it. Quote, "For the time being, the common fallacies about imports are reinforced by politicians and media who depend on sports metaphors to confer meaning into its actions, always with the effect of obscuring the benefits of trade. Hence, in the United States, exports are considered Team USA's points. Imports are the foreign team's points. The trade account is the scoreboard, and the several hundred billion dollar trade deficit means that Americans are losing in trade. And they're losing, so the story goes, because their trade partners cheat." That's very well put, and it's exactly the way a lot of people think. Nobody questions that. Why not?
You know, I think it's easy to fall into this trap of embracing sort of nationalist rhetoric. We have to do something for America. Team America needs to rise to the challenge. We are these upstanding global citizens who are abiding the global trade rules. Yet our trade partners like China or Mexico are cheating, and we need policies that are going to improve America's status and its economic situation. The fact is that trade is not conducted at the national level. It is no team sport. Everybody who transacts benefits from transactions, and really all exchange is two people entering into an arrangement to improve their lots. I want to part with as few dollars as possible to get as much in exchange for that. I'm happy about it. The grocer or the hardware store with whom I transact is happy about that. We add all of these transactions up at the national level, and somehow people forget that the goal is to obtain value for yourself. The emphasis shifts to, we need to export more. We need to have access to foreign markets. We need to keep our market closed so that we have a trade surplus. And this administration, in particular, has put a premium on this view that the metric of trade policy success is the trade account. So if we have a trade surplus with a country, we're winning. If we have a trade deficit, we're losing, and we're going to do something about it. We're going to use the size of our market, the importance of the United States to these respective countries, to renegotiate trade deals or to impose some sorts of targets. And that makes no sense. That's going to make us a lot poorer.
And this, of course, this takes us right back to Adam Smith in the 18th century and the demise of mercantilism. Adam Smith came along and explained that the more we trade goods and services, the richer we all get. That was his contribution. But what was the philosophy? Maybe you could go over that for us a little bit. What was the philosophy heretofore, the so-called mercantilist view?
Well, you know, we like to say that Adam Smith in 1776, with publication of The Wealth of Nations, vanquished the mercantilists. The mercantilists at the time thought that it made sense to accumulate as much specie as possible, to accumulate your treasure, to bring back gold. So in other words, today's equivalent would be to export more than you import. But Adam Smith pointed out that the whole purpose of production is consumption. The whole purpose of exchange is to be able to consume more. And, you know, if you think about life in isolation on an island, if I myself had to provide for all of my needs and all of my wants, if I had to make my own clothing and build my own shelter and hunt and harvest my own food, I would live in abject poverty, subsistence.
Mm-hmm.
But trade, if I find somebody else to cooperate with who is better at hunting and harvesting and I'm better at building a house, we can do a little bit better. So the more people who are involved in the wider the scope for trade, the greater the number of people with whom you can transact, the greater the scope for specialization. And the more we can specialize in what we do best, the more we can produce and then exchange. And that's what Adam Smith pointed out. The purpose of exchange is to be able to import more. We like to say that the mercantilists were vanquished by Adam Smith, but mercantilism really is the predominant ethos of trade policy, not just in the United States, but around the world. Trade negotiators come to the table to say, to try to maximize their access to foreign export markets and to minimize the opening of their own markets. But it's the opening of your own markets which really bring the benefits of trade to your people.
At the same time, though, there's a kind of a psychological illusion that's very hard to shake in daily life. To let go of a dollar, to have to spend it, that hurts. To receive a dollar, well, that's fun. It's just, you know, a natural reaction. And so it leads to the conclusion, fallacious, that to import is a form of vice, to export is great. And I have a feeling that's kind of hardwired into the human being.
Well, maybe not really to the human being. It gets confused at the national level. Certainly at the individual level, when you transact with somebody, you have a little smile on your face when you feel like you got a lot more in return for what you gave up. That's importing more than you're exporting. At the national level, we seem to think we need to have a trade surplus. You know, the United States, by the way, is sort of uniquely privileged. It's an incredible privilege that the predominant reserve currency of the world is the U.S. dollar, which means that investors from around the world like to buy U.S. equities, invest in U.S. companies, buy U.S. debt. They hold dollars instead of gold, and that's been the case, you know, since Nixon took us off the gold standard in 1971. The United States has actually run trade deficits for 42 straight years from 1975 on because all these dollars are coming into the United States. We as Americans consume, we recycle those dollars by buying more imported goods and services from foreigners than we sell to foreigners. But that all balances out with the dollars coming back to undergird investment here in the United States.
But in the realm of these, I call them illusions, but they're very tenacious illusions in the popular mind. When we look, for instance, at Germany and Greece, I picked those two countries because they're very much in the news. There's Germany, the exporter. They're big and strong, and they're raking in the dough and selling his cars and everything else. And they look like they're headed for the stars. Meanwhile, Greece is in a handout mode, and it's a beautiful country, but they're broke, and they're making do, and it's kind of pathetic. So that reinforces clearly the impression that it's much better to be an exporter than an importer.
Well, look, exporting is reflects the value of your economy, what you have in your economy. The fact that Greece imports more than it exports and Germany exports more than it imports doesn't explain their relative positions. Having access to foreign markets is important, but we need to recognize that imports are the things that we get to consume without having to produce, without having to expend resources producing. Exports are the things that we produce and don't get to consume. So exports are a means to an end. And the end is imports. The end is consumption. And at the individual level, I think we understand that. But when we sum it up to the national level, when policymakers try to enlist the spirits of the populace behind some common national goal, it's very easy to be sort of jingoistic and nationalistic and to speak in terms of exports represent our might, imports represent our vice. It turns out that half of the value of U.S. imports are intermediate goods. They're the purchases of U.S. companies, U.S. manufacturers, raw
yes.
materials. And so that certainly isn't vice. That's interdependence in the global economy.
Yes, as you pointed out, there's even intermediate products in there. The supply chains bounce back and forth between different countries, and it's all integrated.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly within the U.S. In the North American market, we see all sorts of supply chain transactions, products before they're sold to end users. Sometimes in the auto industry, for example, parts will go back and forth across the Canadian-American border, across the American and Mexican border multiple times because the factory floor, the way I see it, has broken through its walls and now spans borders and oceans. And that's a good thing because that is specialization. That is companies adopting the views of Adam Smith. That's focus on what you're best on. Purchase from abroad what foreigners can produce relatively better. And that model is working for global production. The Trump administration speaks in terms of repatriating these supply chains. Peter Navarro, who has a PhD in economics from Harvard, speaks about making everything, all components in the United States, everything should come from the U.S. That's like saying, I'm going to go back to living by myself and building my own home.
Yes.
Exactly, living in isolation.
Autarky, as the Greeks used to say. But there's another area where you're fighting the same dragons in a way, but it presents a bit differently, and that's the nationality of companies. You point out that doesn't matter as much as it used to. ThyssenKrupp, the German multinational, is in Mobile, Alabama, and Mattel from India is based in Europe, and it's all kind of scrambled. But at the same time, some countries, Japan, Canada, America, have built great companies which are part of the legacy of that economy and of that country. And it may not be wise to see that all bought up by somebody who has a bit more cash in their pockets than we do. I think there is something to be said for encouraging great companies to stay in the country of their birth.
Well, I think there's something to be said to incentivize entrepreneurship and something to be said about incentivizing investment in your own economy. The Obama administration and the Trump administration like to make this distinction between insourcing and reshoring. So in other words, they make a distinction between wooing American companies back to produce in the United States. They distinguish that from attracting foreign companies from producing in the United States. To me, it's the same thing. What we're competing for is not export markets. We're competing for investment in value-added activity, and it happens to be the case that 6.4 million Americans work for foreign-owned companies. Those companies create value in the United States. They tend to pay higher wages, offer greater compensation. The foreign headquartered companies in America, relative to the average manufacturing sector figures, invest more in research and development. They pay more in taxes as a percentage. I'm quoting these kind of haphazardly, but I did a paper a few years ago for a group called the Organization for International Investment and compared this. And so these companies raise the average in the United States. And some people say, well, if it's a greenfield investment, meaning if these companies come here and build a factory from scratch, that's great. They're adding to our capital stock. And they're not detracting from the U.S.-owned stock. But it's the same thing. If a foreign company buys up a U.S. company, well, the owners of that U.S. company are getting the value in that transaction, and these foreign companies are creating more value than the U.S. previous owners were able to create. So this is good for the economy. Outsourcing, when U.S. companies invest abroad, it's primarily to compete better in foreign markets. There's this kind of illustration that most Americans have in their mind of a factory shutting in Ohio and then being re-erected in Mexico, rafter by rafter, bolt by bolt. But in fact, it's really not like that. Outsourcing is very complementary to domestic investment. U.S. companies that invest abroad simultaneously invest more at home at the same time. They're not substitutes, they're complements.
And will we ever have a cultural shift at some point? Because what you're saying is not new in itself. Adam Smith wrote in the 18th century, and practically every economist in every country is saying more or less the same thing. Will the message finally get through? And will we reach a point where countries do not look at their trade surplus as some kind of wonderful fate, and instead we'll look at the quantity and quality of trade?
It's hard to tell. I mean, the globalization has been interrupted in the past. We had a great bout of globalization, economic liberalization in the late 19th century, which ended with the First World War. We've had a period of globalization that's lasted about 70 years now, which to some people looks like it's going to reverse. That's the case, and we see more and more countries cocooning themselves and adopting more nationalistic protectionist policies. The global economy is going to shrink. There's just no question about it. So for the United States to run trade deficits, it really doesn't matter, because we do produce, we do print the world's predominant reserve currency. For smaller countries, well, generally they can't run trade deficits for very long because the value of the currency will go down dramatically, and then they won't be able to import as much and they'll have to export. So there's a natural mechanism in place that forces countries to change policies. The United States, it doesn't really exist because we get the dollars coming back in as investment anyway.
You do point out that the main reason the Great Recession did not turn out like the Great Depression is because of all these measures that we put in the 30s to prevent fence building around countries and around economies. But you also say that the fence building may start up again. So will we fall back into something as dark as the 30s?
That's true. So in 2008, 2009, during the financial crisis and the Great Recession, G20 ministers were going around reassuring each other that they wouldn't engage in protectionism. And by and large, we didn't have that descent into protectionism. There were some trade remedies like anti-dumping and countervailing duty cases, which tend to be counter-cyclical when the economy is slowing down. So, but nothing like the 30s, nothing like this tit-for-tat exchange. And I attribute that to two things. Yes, we do have these global trade rules, which have done a great job of preventing trade frictions from blowing out of control. But we also have cross-border investment and transnational supply chains. So in the United States, in Washington, lobbying the government, are companies that rely on imports. In 1930, a product made in the United States was almost entirely made in the United States, from the raw material to the final product. Product made in Germany, same thing. Canada, same thing. Now, because we have these global supply chains, there is a vested interest that counters the domestic producers to counsel the government in favor of openness. And it's still there. I think they've been cowed a little bit in the early months of the Trump administration, and a lot are fearful that they don't want their company names coming up in a Trump tweet, because it tends to drive down the stock value in the course of a day. But I'm rather confident that if some of the protectionist rhetoric that we've heard from this administration and its officials goes into effect, we will see massive amounts of opposition, and I think that will be sufficient to prevent us from descending into the abyss. Maybe I'm just optimistic and just a hopeful kind of person, but there are huge vested interests in openness that have been silent up until now, and we'll see what happens going forward.
Does the morality of an economy matter? I'm thinking here of countries like China. I mean, it's an open secret that China has stolen all kinds of intellectual property over the years, or copied things simply with shoddier results. And we're not even talking here about their currency. Just the way they produce and the way they take the benefit off of some of the things that we've innovated with and produced and so on. Does that matter? Does it, does globalization feel that pinch or not?
Well, look, I think the international trade rules are important and should be abided. I think China has not played by the rules in a lot of cases. The United States also flaunts the rules and its obligations as well. I would say not on the same scale as China does, but to be honest, the United States is more likely to be out of compliance with a decision from the World Trade Organization's dispute settlement body than any other country. You know, the World Trade Organization will hear complaints from members. One country will allege that the United States is not fulfilling its obligations. And if it rules against the United States, it says we find the United States law to be in violation of this article of this agreement, and we recommend that the United States bring its law into conformity with the agreement. It doesn't tell the United States what it has to do, but if the United States doesn't come into conformity, the complainants in the case can petition for retaliation. The United States is able to endure retaliation more than other countries, and so in many cases it has not complied. That said, yes, China has engaged in a lot of nefarious activities, and I think that's one of the reasons that we are in the situation we are now with the politics. There are people responding to the fact that maybe we haven't been we haven't held China's feet to the fire as much. Economically, we benefit when the Chinese subsidize their steel industry and export cheap steel to us. Politically, it's untenable because you lose support for trade, as we've seen. So the rules of trade are important. We do need to make sure that China abides those rules, but we're not going to do a good job of that if we start unilaterally abandoning that system and implementing our own trade barriers, as has been threatened.
And the movement of people, too, on a massive scale, that's something that was unforeseen, certainly didn't exist in Adam Smith's day. And I'm thinking here of immigration, but also migrants, refugees from wars, and so on. It's all about the bottom half, the poorer bottom hemisphere of the world, wanting to live in the upper, richer hemisphere, and the upper half doesn't have the resources to absorb all that. And so this is no longer just about goods and services. It's about warm bodies. It's about people moving around on a massive scale. Globalization never had that and never took that into account. Brexit reflects a little bit of that fear.
This is true. This is part of the equation that we need to think very clearly about. The type of migration flows we've seen in the past few years have the added element of having an association with danger and terrorism, and it's very easy for nationalists and populists to make political hay out of that situation. But we need to be, our governments need to be cognizant and responsive to their citizens. But at the same time, recognizing that these global situations do require accommodation of these migration flows. When people come here to work in the United States or come to Canada to work, by and large, it's excellent for the U.S. and the Canadian economies, respectively, to allow these people in. For starters, people who want to emigrate are self-starters. They tend to have to produce a disproportionate number of entrepreneurs, successful business owners. They are self-starters, and these are the kinds of people that we should certainly be embracing. And so our immigration, certainly the American immigration system, is broken, and we need desperately to fix that.
Well, Daniel Lickinson, since you are an optimist, and we do know that boom and bust follow each other like night and day, I'm going to let you predict the next boom.
Well, hopefully it's not a bubble boom caused by this massive infrastructure spending that that Trump's been talking about. You know what? The global economy is rebounding. There is growth on every continent. Even the Eurozone is starting to experience growth. And so, you know, a lot of the economists out there, the financial economists, who like to say that when there's a financial crisis, it takes 8 or 9 years to unwind and to hit growth targets again. But look, the problem we have is we've been below the long-term growth rate of 2% for a long time, and we need to find ways to get back to that. And there's a lot of there are a lot of areas certainly within the U.S. regulatory system, tax system, that can be overhauled to help the United States achieve that goal.
Well, that sounds great, and when it happens, we'll have you back to celebrate it.
Sounds great, Bob.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Daniel Lickinson was our guest this week on the Free Markets series of The World Show. I'm Bob Scully. Have a great week. Thanks.
Bob Scully's World Show was brought to you by Walter Surface Technologies. Only the best. And by Clarks Technologies. Lighting the way to a brighter future.